So with that, I will introduce Jeremy Rosen. Jeremy is one of the most prominent conservative attorneys in California. As an appellate attorney at Horvitz and Levy, he has litigated scores of appeals in the Ninth Circuit, the California appellate courts, the US Supreme Court, and has particular expertise in litigating First Amendment issues. From 2013 to 2019, he also directed the pro bono Ninth Circuit Appellate Advocacy Clinic at Pepperdine. Apropos to the topic today, in 2018, he was nominated by President Trump to serve as US District Court Judge for the Central District of California. But as some of you may know, thanks to a certain former senator and current vice president, his nomination lingered until it finally lapsed on January 3rd, 2021, earning him the dubious honor of being the longest pending, and as he would put it, the longest suffering Article III nominee in the country. Also apropos to today's topic, however, he is a longtime member of the Federalist Society, a frequent moderator and panelist at our chapter's events, and previously served as a president of the Federalist Society's Los Angeles chapter. So it's our pleasure to welcome him back to moderate today's panel. Jeremy?
Thank you very much, Josh, for the kind introduction, and welcome to everyone here who is watching virtually. Hopefully, in the not too distant future, we'll be able to have our events in person again. I'm delighted to be the moderator for today's panel that will provide, I think, some very thoughtful discussion on the impact of the Trump presidency on the rule of law and the future of the conservative and libertarian legal movement. I am joined today by four prominent conservative and libertarian lawyers who will share their varied perspectives. But before I introduce them to speak for the bulk of the panel, I will exercise the moderator's privilege to set the stage for the debate with my own reflections on the topic at hand. My views, for better or worse, are my own and do not represent the views of any organization I am affiliated with. The Trump presidency has certainly ignited very strong opinions, and I expect that some of you, or many of you, might disagree with what I have to say or what many of our panelists will have to say. But that is why it is actually so important for us to have this debate today. As Isaiah the prophet said to Hezekiah, "Thus says the Lord, set your house in order." While there is much to criticize in the new Biden-Harris administration, before we can get to that important task, conservative and libertarians must engage in a reckoning on the state of their legal movement after President Trump and look within to see where our movement may have strayed from its core principles. To begin with, I think it's important to define our terms. I'm an appellate lawyer, after all. What do we mean by the conservative and libertarian legal movement? I think the Federalist Society's website provides a good start at a definition. The state exists to preserve freedom, the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. In other words, the goals of our legal movement are to advance the rule of law and to promote fidelity to the Constitution. I also happen to be a child of the 1980s, and my hero then, as now, was Ronald Reagan. He also had things to say that are relevant to defining broadly what we mean by the conservative and libertarian legal movement. In his view, America has since its founding been a refuge for those suffering under the yoke of oppression. A belief in the dignity of man and government by the consent of the people lies at the heart of our national character and the soul of our foreign policy. The question we have to discuss today is, did President Trump help or hurt the conservative and libertarian legal cause of respecting freedom, advancing the separation of powers, enhancing a judiciary that says what the law is, and promoting human rights, the rule of law, and human dignity? In short, was President Trump actually a conservative, as that term has long been understood? To further help frame our discussion today, I'll borrow the title of a famous Clint Eastwood film, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I do part ways with some of the left-wing critics of President Trump because I believe that his administration did succeed in some respects. We saw three new Supreme Court justices, 54 new circuit judges, and 177 new district and other Article III judges. Among this group are numerous highly qualified and principled men and women who spend each day advancing the rule of law. At roughly 25% of the federal judiciary, these great judges will play a positive role in our country for decades to come. Of course, I am also partial to some of the failed nominees as well. While I won't speak about myself, given that this is a Los Angeles chapter event, it is appropriate for us to acknowledge the 9 highly qualified California judicial nominees that were unfairly blocked by then Senator Harris. It is a real shame that great people like Rick Richmond and Sandy Nunez-Leal did not join the federal bench. They too would have advanced the rule of law every day had they been confirmed. The Trump administration also made strides in curbing the excesses of the administrative state by promoting needed regulatory reform. On the international scene, peace agreements between Israel and Arab nations were nothing short of a miracle, and the gross abuses of the rule of law in China and Iran were highlighted, even though actual concrete policy successes did not occur as a result of our actions. But, and I think this is the important part of our conversation today, I also strongly believe that as conservatives and libertarians, we need to acknowledge that the bad and ugly of the Trump administration were, well, bad and ugly. To start, President Trump regularly demeaned and belittled women, veterans, disabled people, and the list goes on. We should expect our public servants to be decent and honorable people who treat every person with dignity and respect. Can you imagine President Reagan or Justice Scalia using such slurs? Of course not. I also recognize that our immigration policy is one of intense and spirited debate. But even if you agree, as I do, with the need to have a secure border, the Trump administration fell short in our obligations to protect human rights and human dignity by separating children from their parents and by making it nearly impossible for those people with legitimate claims for asylum based on gross human rights violations from having an opportunity to pursue such claims. And the president also deliberately ignored the substantial human rights violations occurring in Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, to name just a few countries. And most ugly of all was the armed attack on our nation's capital. Not since 1814, when the capital burned at the hands of a foreign enemy, has the capital faced such peril. But this time, the enemy wasn't a foreign power seeking to subjugate the United States, but a mob egged on by a president seeking to cling to power at all cost, even after losing the presidential election. During his address to the protesters just before the mob invaded the Capitol, our president told the crowd to fight like hell and stood approvingly when the crowd shouted back, "Take the Capitol now and invade the Capitol." It is, however, worth noting that by my count, 10 different judges appointed by President Trump participated in rejecting various of his frivolous post-election legal challenges. The rule of law prevailed through their principled actions of those judges, as well as judges appointed by other presidents of both parties. So what is the future of our legal movement? Did our movement contribute to some of the truly awful things that happened in recent years? How do we weigh the good versus the bad of the Trump years? I am an optimist, and I believe that with some self-reflection and tough love, the conservative and libertarian legal movement can refind its way and return to its important principles. There are, after all, some brilliant scholars at Heritage, AEI, Cato, Reason, and sprinkled throughout the academy, as well as many other leaders throughout the country who are dedicating to promoting the public good and the rule of law. And our nation desperately needs a principled conservative and libertarian legal movement to combat the threats to the rule of law that we are and will be facing from the power of unchecked progressives during the next 4 years. Today, we have 4 incredible panelists who join me to discuss these and other issues. Orrin Kerr is a nationally recognized law professor at Berkeley, and if you don't follow him on Twitter, you should. Greg Nunziata has had a distinguished career in public service, working for various Republican senators, and is now a partner at Manat Phelps & Phillips. You should follow him on Twitter too. Manny Klausner is a co-founder of Reason Magazine and the General Counsel of the Individual Rights Foundation. And finally, Sam Raimer served in the White House Counsel's Office and numerous other senior positions in government and is now a partner at Norton Rose and Fulbright. In a moment, each of the panelists will share their introductory remarks on this topic. We will then move into a back and forth discussion with questions from the moderator. But I would also encourage all audience members to take advantage of the question and answer tab to post questions now, and I will do my best to work in those questions during the entirety of the question and answer session. And I would encourage spirited questions as well as, I'm sure, spirited debate. So without further ado, I will turn it over to Orrin for his opening remarks.
Thanks, Jeremy, and thanks to the LA chapter of the Federal Society for hosting this important discussion. When I was in LA, I had a great time meeting many of the people in the chapter. It's a wish I could be there in person with you, but at least we can be here virtually for now. So I take our topic to be the impact of the Federal Society, or sorry, the impact of the Trump years on the conservative and libertarian legal movement. And at the outset, I think it's important to recognize we can take that question in a lot of different directions. Are we focused on the Federal Society? Are we focused on libertarian conservative ideas? Are we focused on the impact in the short term and the long term? There are a lot of different ways that we can approach this question. So I'm gonna put the ambiguity aside and offer a take, and I'm sure we'll all approach this from different directions and see where we end up. So it seems to me that if you wanna measure the impact of the Trump presidency on conservative and libertarian legal ideas and the legal movement, it really depends on whether you focus on power or ideas. If you focus on power, it seems to me these were good years in the short term. If you focus on principles and ideas, I think the picture is quite dark. It seems to me that for many conservative and libertarian lawyers, the Trump administration is something of a Faustian bargain. And so there's these two different sides to counter, and it depends ultimately where you come out on which you care more about, the power side or the principles and ideas side. So the case for it being a good time in terms of power is probably pretty straightforward. There were a lot of conservative judgeships that were vacant, and a Senate that didn't have a great experience actually passing legislation. Not a great time for legislation, but the Senate could certainly get 50 votes together to confirm judges. And so there were a lot of vacancies that came up, and a lot of conservatives that filled those vacancies. And there were many strong judges that were nominated and confirmed during that time. And so just from that perspective, if you're focused on sort of are conservative and libertarian lawyers in power, then that obviously that's a great, great time. But how about ideas and principles, which is more where my focus is? It seems to me that this was a deeply troubling time for ideas within the conservative and libertarian legal movement. Trump is really unique, it seems to me, at least in the American political tradition, of really thinking that law and rules are for chumps, for suckers, like who would follow law? He had sort of a fundamentally illegal view of the world, where just law is irrelevant, and why would you bother to follow the law unless there's some direct punishment that you might face? It's just why bother? And you can see this throughout the Trump presidency. And let me just offer a couple of examples. Sending his private lawyer to a foreign country to try to put the squeeze on foreign government officials to announce an investigation into his likely future rival. Expressing absolute outrage over his attorney general for following the recusal ethics rules for recusing from an investigation, telling his own officials to violate the law and telling them, if you violate the law and you get in trouble, don't worry, I will pardon you. Trying to put the squeeze on state election officials to give him some extra votes in a contested election. Making false claims of massive election fraud to try to put the squeeze on Congress. Using pardons to help his friends who were loyal to him. This is sort of president as mob boss for 4 years. And I think for conservative and libertarian lawyers, at a first commitment devoted to the idea of the rule of law, to associate with that and to go along with that, in some cases to provide cover for that, or just to be quiet about that, to make a deal with that, kind of a quid pro quo, we will go along with this if we get something out of it too. That strikes me as a very troubling Faustian bargain. Now, I don't wanna say that everyone took this view. Of course, we're talking about a lot of different people. I and many, a group of other conservative and libertarian lawyers founded a group, Checks and Balances, which is designed to very much express the view that I've articulated for the last few minutes against the threat to the rule of law posed by the last administration. But it seems to me that we need to come to terms with what the Trump administration meant, and that what I think the real question is, what do our commitments to the rule of law mean if our view of the Trump administration was that it was fine? or it was something you can do business with. I think soul searching is needed into what our values truly are if we're on board with that. And with that, I'll offer it. I think Manny's next.
Yep, on to Manny.
All right. Well, thank you, Orin. I agree that there is a kind of a Faustian bargain here. And unfortunately, politics tends to, at best, offer the possibility of a Faustian bargain. And sometimes there's nothing good involved in the Faustian bargain. It's all evil. So I think we have to look at Trump and his record and his performance in the context of the time that we're in, and in the context of the trajectory of what's happening to America in the 20th century, now the 21st century. We have a string of an ever-growing opposition to free market ideas, principled ideas of liberty coming from the left. The left, it stops at very little these days. Leading people on the left began from before Trump was inaugurated to attack him as having stolen the election because of Russian influence. And there was nothing to that. It was totally false. But the massive assault on Trump would have done in, I think, most Republican incumbents. They would have been totally ineffective and probably maybe would have gone along for the ride. I think if we look back at recent presidents, I think Ronald Reagan stands out as somebody who in his heart and in his soul believed in liberty and America. And he effectuated that in his policies in many ways. Now, I'm a libertarian and I interviewed Ronald Reagan for Reason Magazine. It's a historic interview. But I would say that in that interview, Ronald Reagan mentioned the heart and soul of conservatism is libertarianism. And he followed policies to pursue in a variety of areas, something that other presidents have been unwilling or unable to do. Now, if you look at candidates who, if Trump had not been elected, would, or in recent years, we look at George Romney, we look at Jeb Bush, we look at John McCain. These are not principled free market conservatives who have a voice and an ability to withstand withering opposition from before you get elected to what you're trying to stand for. I want to mention a book that I think is worth reading by everyone who's listening to this broadcast. And it's Charles Kessler's recent book, The Crisis of the Two Constitutions. Charles Kessler is a noted conservative scholar at Claremont. And he gives, I think, the most balanced approach to Trump and his record that I've seen. And because there is a time, and I don't know how much more I have because I'm not timing myself, but let me just try to wind down.
About a minute or two.
Okay, thank you, Jeremy. You know, when Obama was president, he was continuously apologizing for America. He ran and he said before he got elected, I'm going to transform America. Trump is very much in the Alinskyite tradition. He didn't believe in the free market and he believed in massive government. Now the left has been infected these days with all kinds of anti-capitalism, anti-liberty, anti-individualism and racist attitudes. And we're dealing in a different world. I think Trump was a force against that. And you may think he's a little rough on the edges. And there's no doubt he's not a person that a lot of people will cotton to. But I look at the record of judicial appointments that's been mentioned. I look at his agency appointments. I look at what he has done in the Justice Department and the Civil Rights Division, particularly. I've done a lot of work involving racial preferences. I was a key supporter of Prop 209. I'm saying that Trump stood to preserve these important structural protections of liberty and against racism. So I think we have to look at the good with the bad. I think the case against Trump is a lot weaker when we balance it against his great contributions, and we can make some more points to that as we go forward.
Thank you, Manny. Greg.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate both of those sets, three of those sets of remarks. I'm glad we're having this conversation. It's certainly a good thing for the conservative and libertarian legal movement that we stop and take stock of where we are. My view of this is, I think it's inescapable to conclude that our experience of the last few years and this relationship between the Trump administration and the conservative libertarian legal movement is that the experience was corrupting and that our movement has been tarnished by it and our credibility has been weakened. I think, yes, certainly lots of good judges, a good deal of good policy, things I care about too. But if you zoom back, I think the entire constitutional edifice and the public common assumptions on which it rests are all weaker today than they were before Trump was inaugurated. And in part, they're weaker because I think the right and the legal right in particular fell short of its proper role in our public debates. Many people began to put personality before party and party before principle. And that is precisely backwards. January 6th was an indelible stain, but I think it was the culmination of lots of things that were in the water from the jump. And it's an embarrassment for our movement that so many individuals in and out of government who've been associated with our movement played roles in that chain of events, prominent roles, and most have not backed off or reconsidered or apologized for what they did. So we started the Trump presidency at a unique moment for the conservative legal right. The Federal Society and our friends were not as exotic as we once were. We were a dominant voice in the party. In fact, Trump's victory can be credited in part to the conservative legal movement forcing him to put out a list of judges and making these kinds of commitments. We should have been in a role where we continued to keep this administration honest on rule of law issues beyond judges. But it seemed that we settled for judges and were willing to go largely silent on many, many other areas. Trump, upon inauguration, showed just in his basic comportment what a danger he was. He had no sense of his head of state role, no sense of stewardship of the Constitution or the people he led. I remember one of his first interviews in the Oval Office with Bill O'Reilly when he was asked about Putin being a killer, and his answer was, well, you know, we're killers too. You think we're so innocent? There's just kind of equivocation of America with some of our some of the worst regimes around the world. He deliberately and relentlessly inflamed faction in ways that are unusual in our history and which the founders knew were what would be a long-term threat to the ability of our system to function. He lied about the first election, insisting that he actually won the popular vote and there were 3 million illegal votes out there. In so doing, just undermining the confidence of the American people in their core fundamental institutions. I think that all this went on with a largely a culture of silence on the right and an increasing tendency to view our politics in purely Manichaean terms and to for folks on the right to feel like they ought not criticize Trump because he was with us in some important fights. I think that's a big mistake. And it certainly played out in Congress. You saw a real reluctance to challenge the president on toxic rhetoric, on any policy deviations from conservatism, but more concerning on structural assaults to congressional authority and to the balance of, and separation of powers, whether it was the appointments clause or the emergency declarations to build a wall that Congress didn't fund or the impeachments. You know, in the conservative legal movement have had a great relationship with Senator McConnell over the years. I thought it was pretty damning that one of the most flattering op-eds I read in the last couple months about McConnell's legacy here was that he was Trump's prime minister. That's how Hugh Hewitt put it, and that was a compliment. That's not our system. The Senate is not meant to serve the will of the president, and it's a failure that Republicans continue to see their role that way, and it's our failure as a legal movement to allow them to, and to not call them out on that. We need to get back to the founders' vision of ambition checking ambition. And of course, the ultimate check Congress has on the president is impeachment. We went through it twice, and whatever you thought the outcome should have been, it was disgraceful in both instances how people who knew better rushed to bogus legal arguments to delegitimize the entire process and to undermine a core congressional function to hold presidents accountable. And sadly, there were some notable conservative legal voices involved in that process. And I think we are much worse off after going through it twice with conservatives not standing up for institutions and not standing up for congressional authority. So my takeaway or lessons of the last few years is I think that we need to remember that the conservative or libertarian legal movement has a mission that is separate from conservatism or libertarianism more broadly and separate from the Republican Party and certainly separate from whatever the interests of the Trump family might be. We need to focus on our vision of the Constitution and the rule of law. We need to understand that courts are not enough to save the Constitution. The other two branches matter, and we need to put more resources and thought into Articles 1 and Articles 2. And finally, we can't keep this Constitution without a people who fundamentally believe in it and support it. And I think we on the right, on the legal right, probably need to invest more in just basic civics and in restoring the popular understanding of the Constitution and the legitimacy of our institutions, which I think Trump did a great deal to undermine. I think that's 5 minutes, so thank you.
Thank you, Greg. And last but not least for our opening remarks, Sam, thank you for being patient.
No problem. Thank you very much. First of all, let me just say, these are my own private remarks. They are not endorsed by my firm, Norton Rose Fulbright. I'm not speaking on behalf of them. I only speak on behalf of myself as a private individual and as an attorney. And thank you very much for enabling me to be here. I would just like to begin by saying in my brief remarks that if we think that we're in a unusual period of time, I would just like to quote Alexis de Tocqueville, who said that scarcely any political question arises in the US, which is not resolved sooner or later into a judicial question. And so I think that sort of sums up what we're faced with here. Can the Federalist Society, which is a group dedicated to the advancement of a certain type of interpretation of law, a certain type of set of values for the Constitution and respect for a certain kind of analysis, what is its role, if any, in politics? And so if you're asking about what the Trump administration's effect was on the conservative libertarian legal movement, I would have to beg off respectfully and say that it's, of course, been good and bad, just the way Mr. Rosen said a few minutes ago. First of all, I think it's important to note that the Trump campaign and the Trump administration centered on originalist thought in judicial interpretation more than any administration, any president we've seen in our lifetime. I think we can agree on that. Reagan, of course, was good for the movement, very good for the movement. George W. Bush followed it up with some very excellent selections to the bench. But the Trump administration actually proselytized for Federalist Society, for constitutionalist judges in a way that we had never been seen before. And I think that's very, very important to keep in mind. Because what happened to our movement is it became, I believe, and will continue to be, a part of the cultural fabric in the country now. And because of that, the Federalist Society and the judges that are in place because of the Federalist Society have a changing role. The whole idea of the constitutionalist libertarian movement and FedSoc has been about judicial process. What is the best way of making a legal ruling? What's the best way of getting to the answer? The liberal side of the equation has always been more about, we do what we need to do in order to achieve our policy goals. We have a living constitution. The constitution should be interpreted in a way to achieve certain policy goals, which we think are fair and equitable and progressive and, basically explain themselves in an emotional statement that one makes in favor of the policy. And so judges have always been able to, on the left side, have always been able to use the process in order to get their particular policy goals going. The two arguments supported each other. The living constitution supports the policy goal. The policy goal supports the living constitution. our side, the Federalist Society's position, has not been that clear cut. And I go back to that great interview that Scalia made back with 60 Minutes, where he very simply explained that he was as restrained by originalism as a liberal jurist would be. The way he said it in the interview was, and I'm paraphrasing, he said, there are lots of evil conservative things that Scalia would like to do to this country, but Scalia can't, because Scalia is bound by originalism just as much as somebody on the left is. And the goal is, of course, to keep the judiciary from becoming so random and so based upon whether a judge is getting up on the left side or the right side of the bed, that law in effect means nothing. And so while our movement was greatly promoted by the Trump administration, and while I think that the publishing of a list of potential judges ahead of the election was a very, very good thing for transparency and for the political life of the country, and I would like to see that, I would actually like to see that continue. The fact is, because it became so popular, or at least within the Republican Party, the set of expectations on the movement has changed and has been increased. There's a difference between a textualist or originalist view of the Constitution and a conservative policy goal view of the Constitution. That's if you have a conservative wish list of things that you want to do, that doesn't necessarily mean they dovetail perfectly with a textualist interpretation of the law and of the Constitution. And that's going to set up, I think, an increasing problem for the Federalist Society. If you're selling the fair reading of the Constitution, the fair reading of the law, if you're selling also the idea that there's going to be a conservative revolution in terms of policy as far as the courts go, then I think you're setting up we're setting up a set of expectations that conservative jurists are not going to be able to satisfy. And we've seen rumblings of that with Senator Hawley's recent speech, where he alleged that the Bostock decision was basically the death of textualism, that because textualism was used to redefine Title VII, then textualism thus means nothing. Of course, it's textualism the way Senator Hawley interprets it to be, which means, you know, conservative policy goals. And so the Federalist Society and the conservative legal movement is more powerful than ever, bigger than ever, and the expectations upon it now are not troubling, but complicated. And it's going to lead, I think, to a lot of turbulence in the future as conservative jurists and Republican politicians navigate this sense of expectations versus the actual tool that conservative originalist interpretation provides. And the Federalist Society has to make a decision, I think, about whether it's going to actually be an organization dedicated to the principle of originalist thought and interpretation of the Constitution and law, or whether it's going to try to step into the political arena and punish political behavior that it does not like, or does not feel actually fits into its interpretation of the Constitution. And so I don't know how long, I didn't set my timer before I talked, but that's basically the set of ideas that I would like to begin with. And I might have more to say, of course, as my distinguished colleagues fill this discussion with more brilliance.
Well, thank you very much, Sam. And thank you for all of those opening remarks. I think we've really set the stage for debate. My plan is, I'm sort of going to go back to you in order with, I think, a question I've come up with, sort of coming off of each of your remarks. And for the audience, I will note we already have quite a number of good audience questions, and I'll try to start weaving those in sort of the next round of questions. But I'll go back to Oren, and you made the distinction between power versus principles, and I guess I want to just push you to on that a little bit. In that, isn't it possible that sometimes the exercise of power can lead to principles? And I guess the way I would look at it is on judges. The judges getting through, as you pointed out, were sort of an exercise of raw power, but those judges will be on the bench for the next 20 to 30 years, hopefully engaging in principled decisions. So is it really as black and white, power versus principle, or just curious your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's the best argument for why power politics is, oh, it's actually, this is, you know, if I win now, it'll all work out best for great principles, because I promise those principles will come and kick in eventually. I mean, that's the argument, right? But it seems to me this is, it's just interesting talking to different people that there's sort of a core commitment to the rule of law. And the Trump administration tested that. And I think just different people had really different reactions to how serious a threat that is and how fundamental that commitment is. And I think in the, I totally recognize in the political system as a practical matter, you know, you can't always do it. You insist on everything being exactly perfect and compromises are going to be made. But I think this was just a compromise way too far. This was really giving up so much in the way of principle that from the beginning, at least my reaction was like, I'm out from the get-go. So I recognize that's the argument, but you know, if you're going to take that approach, I think you also have to look at all sides, like not only what might happen in the short term with a certain set of judges that are confirmed, but what's the blowback to that? What's the reaction to that? What is the next generation of people coming up? How do they react to these ideas? And you know, if you want to make the arguments about sort of how this will go over time, the ideal time would be to have these arguments, you know, in 20 years or 30 years, and we can look back on the effect of the Trump administration writ large. So I think we're at a disadvantage in trying to answer that in the short term. But I recognize there's it's more complicated than the simple way that I presented it. But I think that dynamic actually does capture the key questions here.
And actually, what Oren just said is a good segue into my question for Manny, which is, in your remarks, you talked about how other Republicans besides Trump, in your view, would have been sort of weak and sort of caved in to the left and would not have done some of the things he did. But isn't the counter to that, because of the reaction to the excesses of the Trump years, we now have a very energized progressive movement that we didn't necessarily have 4 years ago that now has almost complete power in Washington? And I'll add in actually one of our audience questions as sort of a part B to this, which is sort of what can we make of the future of our two-party system in light of the emergence of people like Trump and Sanders who sort of work outside the party system? So.
Well, I think that the reaction to Trump was existing and would have existed in many ways without Trump. Look at the attacks that were made on George Romney when he ran for president, as what an evil person he was. And he, if there was anybody that you would think is above that kind of attack of as being evil, he's a fair-minded, ethical person from all standpoints, but he was Republican. And so he became fair game. I think the American political system has been a gloves off approach by the left, where they don't stop at anything to get rid of the Republicans who stand in their way. And I think this whole Mueller commission, this whole investigation, we know was all made up, but because the press is not a free press anymore, and it operates in practice very much like an organ of the Democratic Party, or at least an ally that gives it unpaid aid and comfort by hiding bad news about Democrats and by misleading and inventing bad news about Republicans. Now, I believe in a multi-party system. I might mention as a footnote, I've been a member of the Libertarian Party since it was organized. I live in California, so it's easy for me to vote for principle and not worry about whether I'm going to cause the left to win. That doesn't happen in California. But if I were in a land, if I'm in a state where it's competitive, I would take a closer look at what the impact of my personal vote would be. But there's no doubt that as a libertarian, I strongly favored Trump, A, absolutely, and B, relatively to what the Democrats offer. I think the Democrats, seriously, there's a mean streak in many Democrats. They hate America. They hate equal opportunity. They hate the idea that people are not racists. They're promoting openly and fervently racist ideas across the board and extending it and requiring it now in public schools, not at just the University of California law schools. I don't know what Oren's experience is at Berkeley in that, but I during the Prop 209 campaign or the Prop 16 campaign, which preserved 209, shortly after it was over, the president of the University of California sent a letter with statements from the deans of each of the University of California law schools strongly supporting, indicating their support for critical race studies. Now, what we're seeing is a wholesale attempt to manipulate public opinion from grammar school up. And you're teaching people that equal opportunity and treating people regardless of their race, regardless of the color of their religion, they should be treated differently. This is not the America that we as conservatives or libertarians treasure and value. And that's what Trump stood for. He loved the country and the tradition. He wasn't your ideologue in a principled sense, no question about that. But he had a deep, I think, and a deep abiding trust in the heritage of America and fought by, and you could see it by one of his great policy achievements that we all agree on, his judicial appointments will help for the legacy of Trump will live on for decades in ways that would have been unbelievable. I don't think that name another contender for president that could have achieved what Trump did for that advanced the goals and the values of conservatism and libertarianism. Can you think of any?
And on that, go to Greg.
Yeah, and then let me just make one point because just as a response. So the name Josh Hawley was mentioned, and I want to just happen to have a copy of the current issue of Reason magazine. And if you can see that, the current issue of Reason has a big picture of Josh Hawley, and we call it the dark future of the title, The Dark Future of the GOP, Josh Hawley's Toxic Populism. And it's written by Peter Sudeman. I highly recommend that article to you. That's another area where we really have to be fearful where the Republican Party can go, because we need the principles. The one of the beauties of originalism, it's not just result oriented. Yes, it favors systematic, clear approach to making decisions with integrity that stand on a base of protecting liberty. But this is an alternative. And if you dislike somebody who's flawed like Trump and don't weigh in the scales his great strengths and commitment to America and the values we share, I think that you have to look for another candidate and tell me who wins.
So I think we've now established that Manny should help out the Senate Republicans on the filibuster side of things, because he could talk for longer than many of them. But
you got to use the axe.
But well, thank you. And now I'll turn to Greg. So Greg, in your comments, you made a number of points about how many members, in your view, of the conservative movement were tarnished by the role in Trump. And I guess, the left, I think we often will criticize for sort of the cancel culture impulses, I think quite correctly, but of course there's always a line that can't be crossed. I guess sort of a two-part question. One is, what is your view of, how we should, how we should forgive or not people who, in your view, cross the line? What consequences should there be? And to sort of fold in one of our audience questions, who asks, obviously none of us here can speak officially for the Federal Society, but the question for the audience asks whether organizations, including the Federal Society, should be concerned about taking stands about people who have crossed certain lines. And if you're comfortable sharing your views on that, please do.
Yeah, look, I think the Federal Society exists to welcome a diversity of ideas and to be a platform for debate. And we all are going to have different opinions about President Trump, about policy issues, about even the events that led up to January 6th. And I think, all things equal, we should favor hearing from more voices and not disinviting people from participating in debates. I do think that we ought to be concern, particularly when members of the Federalist Society or people who are associated with the Federalist Society cannot embrace the core principles that we should share with respect to the rule of law, the Constitution, legitimacy of our institutions. In the weeks between the election and January 6th, you know, there was a range of behavior, and a lot of it was negligent. Some of it was reckless, and some of it was worse. So there are lots of different individuals. I'm not going to go through them all now, but we should certainly hold people, particularly in people in public life, accountable for what they did during that time period. We should hold elected officials who claim to be conservatives and constitutionalists accountable for continuing today to kind of cast doubt on the legitimacy of the election and the certification of the results. So in general, err in the direction of more debate and more voices, but hold people to account. And also, you know, the Federalist Society, it's more than an organization. It's all of us, and there are platforms, there are chapters all around the country, and I think every chapter should be thoughtful about who it wishes to highlight and who it wishes to give kind of pride of position at key events.
So turning to Sam, you brought up Senator Hawley's recent speech criticizing originalism, and Manny helpfully gave the visual aid of the recent Reason magazine. And actually, I will say that is, as an aside, one of the things I'm missing most about not being in person is I do always look forward to snagging a free copy of Reason from Manny when we meet in person, because, you know, sometimes I'm cheap, and I do welcome the free copy, although I probably should just start subscribing after all years of taking Manny's free ones. But my question for you, Sam, is, you know, how is Senator Hawley's criticism of originalism any different from the left's view of constitutional interpretation, which is, you know, whatever the sort of the woke progressive cause du jour of the moment somehow magically gets incorporated into a constitutional provision or a statute. Isn't that what Hawley is suggesting, but just from the right? And how is that at all a principled issue that can unite a conservative and libertarian principle movement?
Well, that's a great question. And my answer is, it's sort of like, it depends on where you're standing. It's like it's actually like layers of an onion. If you look at Hawley's argument, Hawley's saying that textualism is dead because it was used falsely in the Bostick argument, which is, you know, sort of taking off on Alito's dissent, where he called the majority opinion in Bostock a more legislating from the bench, flying under the pirate flag of textualism. And so, what's happening is let me just say this, the FedSoc's done an amazing job over the last few decades in presenting originalism and constitutional, you know, strict constitutional interpretation as a principle that everyone wants to get behind. Even liberal legal theorists are now talking about, using originalist thought. There have been articles out there saying, isn't everybody an originalist now? And so what's happening, I think, is everyone's going to want to claim this banner for themselves in getting what it is they want politically to pass through the courts. And I think it requires great discretion and willpower to keep the discussion focused on legal interpretation and legal principle rather than going off in political directions. So the fact is, Senator Hawley is a politician, and Senator Hawley has a particular brand of politics that and a certain constituency that he is trying to arouse. And if you listen to talk radio, for example, right-wing talk radio occasionally, there's tremendous anger within a lot of populists and very, very conservative voices about judges disappointing them because of what I spoke about in my opening statement, which is a set of expectations that, fairly or unfairly, implicitly or not implicitly, were set up when they make an argument for a strict institutional, a strict constructionist viewpoint of the Constitution. If we just go back in time and view the Constitution as written, then we're going to get all of these policy changes that we like. And of course, everyone knows it's much more complicated than that. And so the important role, I think, for those who are in favor of a strict interpretation of the Constitution, textualism, reading it carefully, is to, in my opinion, try to stay as clear from politics as possible and talk really about the actual process and the intellectual rigor and thought behind it. One of the great things about the judges that have been appointed over the last few years is that they're actually really high quality. They're you know, really deep thinkers. They've thought very hard about these issues. They argue about them. They talk about them. And it's not generally about the policy goal. It's about the way you get there. And so Hawley is trying to get to a certain destination while talking about how you get there. And we're going to see more of this. And we're going to see more of these intertwining electric arcs of wanting some particular policy going forward, wanting to legislate from the bench, and everyone grabbing for the strict constructionist tool in order to get us there.
Thank you, Sam. I think what I'm going to do for this next round of questions, and I should say, I'm sort of targeting questions to each one of you, but if anyone else wants to add something after the person I targeted, just, pipe up. We're all friends here. What I thought, since we're getting so many questions from the audience, what I thought I would do in this next round is try to paraphrase or use some of the audience questions and figure out which of you to sick them on. But again, if others want to jump in after that, that's fine. So I'll start with Oren, and the question from the audience member is, he asks that the fundamental question is, do we want to be a polite debating society or affect actual and real change to advance the conservative movement? If the latter, how can your critiques of Trump hold water? So I think, to paraphrase, I think he's saying that you need to go with the power, not the principle. So I think, if you'd like to expand upon your thoughts on that, I think it's very important.
Yeah, I think that's just an unflattering description of the dilemma that I started with. I mean, that's the power versus principle idea. And if principles, if ideas, if the rule of law is just a polite debating society to you, then of course, in fact, all of what the Federal Society is about, you should just ignore it because it's all these ideas and that's not your interest. If all you care about is power, just skip this and go with power. That's easy, right? That's not like a hard, complicated question. So I think I started off phrasing it that way in terms of power versus ideas and principle, because I think that really is the dividing line here. And so, if you're on the other side, that I get it. That's where you are. But I just don't think this is necessarily a form that is going to, the ideas that I hope the Federal Society is about and traditionally has been about is a different sort of set of questions. I also did want to respond to something that Manny said, on which we have a really fundamental disagreement that I wanted to bring out. And what something Manny said was that the liberals, I think it was the left, I don't exactly remember the term used, hates America and Trump loves America. And that's kind of the fundamental divide. And I could not disagree more strongly on that description of things. And I think there's just a fundamental disagreement that we have on this. It seems to me both Americans on the left and Americans on the right love America. We all start from that point that we all love our country. We have fundamental disagreements about what our commitments in our country are about. We all have a commitment to equality under the law, and we just disagree on how to get there. And it seems to me that what Trump did was basically realize that he could demonize the other side and try to win and try to govern by getting, just 50% or depending, because of the sort of quirks of the electoral college system, less than 50%, but close to 50%, and governed by demonizing everybody on the other side. And I don't see that as within the American political tradition of just saying the other side is evil, the other side hates our country, we love our country. That's really just about, I see that fundamentally as a tribal idea of just sort of us versus them. And it seems to me that our country and our Constitution is about greater ideals. And we're just talking about there's a disagreement about how to achieve the commitments of our country, not about whether we love our country in the first place.
Jeremy, could I just jump in?
Oh, please. I was going to call on you, but jump right in.
Good. Okay. Well, I, Maybe I overspoke or misspoke. I don't think that all people on the left hate our country, but I think that there is a sharp divide in many people who reject the virtues of liberty and free minds and free markets, as we say at Reason. And I think a lot of, you know, we have disputes within the conservative movement and within libertarian movement about what that means in practice and how it ought to be put into action. So I don't think that these are simple questions. And maybe I overstated, Oren, and I appreciate your giving me an opportunity to clarify, because I think there are many people on the left who genuinely believe in America, their heritage, and love it. My parents came from Poland. I was born in the Bronx. My parents were Democrats. I didn't know very much about politics really until I got into law school, when I began to get a more complete understanding and got exposed to economists and Hayek and Rothbard and Thomas Sowell and people like that. But I would say there is a fundamental misunderstanding and a very poor, I think the educational system in general does a very poor job. And I think in many ways it does misteach and it preaches against equality. I think this whole movement now for equity instead of equality is against the notion of equal rights. And so I don't think, I really think this is one of the serious objectives. I think the Federal Society can play a large role. And I think one of the beauties for me of the Federal Society, and if you look at our website, we've proudly defined the Federal Society as a movement of conservatives and libertarians. And that brings so much, because there's so much complexity within each of those sides, that it's always going to be room to debate. You can't go to a Libertarian Party convention and have everybody agree, because they don't. And then you bring a bunch of conservatives in, and you're certainly not going to get more agreement. The point is, though, there overlaps. And what I like about Trump is I think he was committed really in his heart to the idea of equality, equality of opportunity. He wanted to get rid of racism. He didn't want the idea of quotas and limits based on people's skin color. That's one of the serious divides in America. It's getting worse. And I think Trump should get credit for being a champion of equality of rights.
So, Greg, we got quite a number of audience questions that I'll sort of mush together, that they're sort of directed at you. And I would say, I think, in disagreement with you. So I'll give you a chance to respond. And they sort of come in two types. One, sort of questioning your view that the impeachment process both times was improperly handled by Republicans, and two, critiquing your claim that there wasn't fraud in the election. So just curious if you, and since this goes to such huge topics, I think other people may want to jump in after Greg, but I'll give Greg the first chance since he was name checked on a few of these questions. So.
Sure. No, I mean, look, I think, as I said in my opening statement, I think the impeachment power is a core congressional function to keep the executive and the judiciary in line. The founders thought it was important. I think if anything, it's been dramatically underused historically, and that Congress should use impeachment to hold presidents and cabinet secretaries and judges to account when they fail to do their jobs, or violate their oaths of office. I think that when the House of Representatives brings an impeachment and sends it over to the Senate has an obligation to conduct a meaningful trial. And senators have the obligation to do that and not to serve the president as in the first instance. And that meaningful trial can result in many things. It can result in conviction and removal, of course, but that's not the only purpose of an impeachment. It has an important oversight function, and senators should have wanted to know more about what happened in the Ukraine affair. And they certainly should have wanted to know more about what happened in the lead up to a violent assault on Congress itself. And when senators failed to do their jobs, in my estimation, and tried to shut the thing down, not collect evidence, move on, demean the whole process as a kangaroo court or a Soviet style inquiry. I don't even know what that means, but that was the refrain in the first impeachment. They're doing a real disservice to the balance of power and to their own institution. I had impeachment. And what was the other thing you wanted me to touch on quickly?
The claims of election fraud.
Sure. I don't deny that there are election irregularities in every election. I've been a Republican poll watcher in Philadelphia many times, so I've seen some shady business. But the idea that millions of votes were stolen, or that there was a coordinated national conspiracy, or that fundamentally our elections are illegitimate, I think is false. And if you're going to make that claim, you sure have to bring some real meaningful evidence, and not a whole lot of insinuation based on a handful of anecdotes that don't tip a presidential election.
All right, turning to Sam, couple of the audience questions sort of wonders, whether the focus of the congressional strategy of the Trump administration, really in the Senate, was mostly just to confirm judges as opposed to legislation. In retrospect, was that the right call, or do you think other things should have been attempted?
Well, it's very difficult when you've got a very narrow balance in the Senate. And I don't think you can take the record of the administration in terms of legislation into account without also taking into account the fact that Trump staged what is basically a hostile takeover of the Republican Party, if you want to put it in a colloquial way. There were many Republican senators who were opposed to Trump and did not want to be very helpful. And that continued for quite a while. And so judges were one thing that all the senators could get behind, and it was a great, and that the executive branch could get behind. And that was done very, very well. We also we have to admit the fact that we had the very good fortune of having Harry Reid as the Senate Majority Leader, who changed the filibuster rules regarding judicial nominations. That was something that had never before, we had not had in the modern era. And so that's really important to keep in mind. There was a real opportunity to put individuals through that had a definitive judicial philosophy that could be identified from their paper trail. Prior to the Trump administration, you wanted a judicial candidate who said nothing. You literally could not find any record. I can just imagine the conversations that must have been had in previous, Republican administrations when they came in for their nominations. I can imagine some of them saying, "Have you written anything?" No. Great. you're perfect. And now, there were actual people I know within the D.C. legal community who, said, I would be a great judge. And I said, "Have you written anything?" And they said, "No." And I said, "Well, forget it. It's not, you're not well suited right now." You have to keep in mind that the political gamesmanship controls everything. The structural of how many senators you have controls just about everything in terms of being able to pass legislation. And we're seeing this now on the other side. The Democrats are seeing this, with trying to keep their coalitions together for what they want to pass. But I really would like to at least stress one thing, if I could. Like Manny, I'm also from the Bronx, and it's good to know Manny and I will have to talk about this later on in a private meeting. But I've also practiced law in New York City for quite a while and tried many cases there. And one of the great, I think, disservices that the judicial nomination process has had over the last few decades is the idea of forum shopping, of judge shopping, that your entire success or failure of your case is going to be based upon which judge you pull. And that is, I think that has contributed to a degree of randomness and lack of stability in the law as clients, as plaintiffs, as defendants experience it, that has a corrosive effect on the free market. Because when you can't be sure about what the law is going to be or how it's going to be enforced, if it's going to be enforced by identity or based on, whether one side seems more sympathetic than another, or if it's going to be based on a strict interpretation of the law as applied to the facts, those factors have a great deal of resonance in terms of whether an area, a neighborhood, a city can thrive or not. And so you see this in cities and communities where the courts are viewed as simply redistributionist, where if you just get sued in that area, you are, if you have deep pockets, you're going to get cleaned out. whether it's fair or not, those areas decline economically and the people who are in those areas suffer. And so I see the Fed stocks role and strict constructionists as very, very important apart from the politics, and that the country does best when there are people who are dedicated to the rule of law in terms of how they're looking at the founding documents, how they're looking at the actual legislation, and how they're doing the application of facts to the law. And when that happens, when politics is put back into the political sphere and out of the judicial arena, then we can have the fight that we really all want to have, which is the political argument. And that's what I think we're all dedicated to getting it out of that. And unfortunately, what I sense sometimes is that we're getting pulled into this political argument as an organization. And that diminishes, I think that diminishes our strength and diminishes our appeal.
Well, let me just add something quickly. So the failure of Congress to legislate, or Republicans in Congress to legislate under Trump, is not about Trump in particular or anything new. It's the result of decades long trends and forces in which Congress has really abdicated its role as the primary policymaking organ of the government. Both parties, for a bunch of reasons, are not doing their job, are preferring to let courts and the executive branch and the administrative state make policy for them. And that's a real, real deep, deep problem. It's, I think, probably the core illness in the health of our Constitution right now. And it's something that the Federalist Society and the conservative legal movement needs to think about, how to restore and revivify Congress and get the thing working. And I know the Federalist Society has the Article I initiative, and there are lots of scholars thinking about it a bit. But maybe I think as lawyers, we tend to think a bit too much about the courts historically, and we need to think a lot more about Congress, which is the first article of the Constitution for a reason.
Of course, Sam, I have to say your comment about writings by judicial nominees was a bit triggering for me, as it reminded me of the many hours of interrogation I went through at the hands of Senator Harris's staff about things I wrote when I was 17. Which apparently were conservative and therefore disqualifying for my nomination. But
I'm sorry about that. I really am.
I think we have about 20 minutes left, and I think what I would like to do is sort of have for lack of a better word, sort of a free for all on sort of a couple basic, I think, themes of debate that have come out from the panelists. On the one hand, we have, I think, Manny's statements that that President Trump was the most anti-racist president who had incredible principles that he was fighting for, versus I think Greg and Oren sort of making the case for all of the significant violations of the rule of law. And I guess the question is, how do we reconcile those two points? And I'd like sort of Manny's take on Greg and Oren's point, and Greg and Oren's point take on Manny's, and then Sam to comment as he sees fit. So why don't we start with Oren, and then we could maybe move to Manny, and then back to Greg and Sam, and as in our order. But feel free to have sort of more of a spirited yet friendly civil debate here.
Yeah, well, I mean, at the outset, I think just Trump as a person, it's hard to describe him as I guess he has described himself as the least racist person in the world. Here's someone who's going back to the 1970s. I mean, he was sort of, I don't even know where to begin in terms of, Trump with his Mexican rapist comment and targeting, from the get-go, he has been associated with inflaming racial tensions as a political tool. That was, a big part of his political strategy. So I certainly can't take him as a person associated with opposition to racism as an essential part of his platform. I think as to his policy views, or maybe the policy views of the administration, I think this goes back to just disagreements about what does equality under the law mean? What is the best approach to achieving American ideals? And yeah, there's just disagreement on these questions, but it seems to me that we can say, yes, there's disagreement on these questions, and they're both legitimate perspectives, and we should, ideally we would want the legislature, not the courts, to try to resolve which of these are are the ones to adopt. But I think they're just disagreements between left and right, and that's to be expected. But that Trump, especially given his personal history, should not, we shouldn't associate him with any grand ideals here. I think I would associate him personally with just about the worst possible set of views on these sorts of questions. And as for his administration, that's going to be a left versus right disagreement.
Well, I think Trump as an individual had many shortcomings. There's no question about it. And he's certainly not a moral philosopher. But I think he had a certain good sense of himself, a good sense of America and its heritage. And he stood for equality of opportunity fundamentally in his heart and his soul and in his policies. And that's a big dividing line politically these days. This the transformation into a quest for equality, into the quest for equity, me is very meaningful and very dangerous. And you look now at this, parents want to have their kids admitted to a school, whether it's a prestigious Ivy League school or a good prep school in many parts of the country. It makes a big difference what your skin color is, much more than how well your kid did or how you did when you're applying. I think Trump stands for the old school approach, the old school belief in equality of rights in this regard. I think he fundamentally embodies that. And he's maybe a little rough and crude on the surface and a little distasteful if you're a real serious intellectual and you want real purity. That's not him nor his conduct or pattern of living over the years. But I think as a president of the United States, he supported the policies that did expand the opportunities for people who have less to have people who have more. And by the way, a lesser flagrant example maybe, but an example I might use is minimum wage laws. A lot of conservatives understand, and libertarians, of course, understand the arguments against minimum wage laws because they tend to block access to untrained, less popular people who are not maybe minorities that are disfavored in a community. They're the first casualties of minimum wage laws. But you don't see, I don't know what George Romney would have done if we had minimum wage laws, if he'd support increasing them or not. And same with Jeb Bush. I think that there are the strict conservatives who understand market economics, who understand Hayek and Sowell and Murray Rothbard and Mises. That's not what Trump was, but he embodied a belief in that idea. He the kid from Queens who came up and did very well for himself, he ended up believing in what the American spirit has offered. And that my parents came here for that. I think many people did. I think it's changing. This is the twilight of equal opportunity in America. And that, I think we should give credit to Trump, dislike him for his personal foibles and his missteps in the past. He, as a policy maker and as president, I think pushed the ball forward in the ways that we generally would support.
Greg?
I guess I won't go too deep into trying to understand what is in President Trump's heart. I don't fault... I think it was sensible for conservatives and libertarians of various stripes to view Trump as a strategic partner or an ally in many of the issues that we care about. I think the mistake was allowing Trump to define us and who we are rather than to understand that we were working through someone whose interests and values are not always aligned with ours. I think, back to power and principle, both matter. Trump seems to have mostly cared about the former, and it's not enough. And just, the defense of Trump that he fights, well, fighting's not enough. I mean, we're in this 50-50 country, and we're not going to meaningfully advance the ball on our policy values or our constitutional views without principle, without convincing people, which Trump demonstrated very little interest in doing. We had a talked to all of us, several of us, I think I've mentioned Reagan. Well, you know, Reagan had these massive elections and changed the political culture of the country and made an imprint of ideas on the rising generation. Can we say that Trump did any of those things? No, I don't think we can.
Sam, anything you want to add on this topic before we move to the next?
No, thanks. You can move on to the next topic.
I just note one sentence, Jeremy, if I could.
Sure.
Make America great again. There were many, many Americans who responded, and there was a love of country involved. And inherent in that was the love of the virtues of the American heritage. Trump embodied that, and I think he made a movement out of that.
My take on it was that he spoke much more to fear about losing the country than to love of country and what it stands for.
Okay, another question we have from the audience is that, you know, is that Trump has criticized judges and justices for their rulings, including those that he nominated when they didn't go his way. Do panelists feel that this could lead potential judicial nominees to be pressed in future vetting processes by future presidents to be more committed to the agenda of a particular president? And I guess I would just add to that, you had the Democrats, I think, properly criticized Trump early on in his administration for the very nasty comments he made about Judge Curiel, who was presiding over a lawsuit against him in the federal courts in Southern California. But then, of course, many Democratic senators made the same type of personal and nasty attacks against people like Judge Rao on the D.C. Circuit when she made decisions as well. And so I guess more broadly, what do the panelists think about politicians of both sides becoming much more nasty and personal in their attacks on judges? And what impact could that have on the rule of law and sort of the public perception of the judiciary, which, at least from my perspective, has been the only functioning branch of government for a good long time? And I guess I'll let, per our usual order, let Oren start with that.
You know, I actually am most curious about what Greg thinks about that, having spent a lot of time on judicial nominations in the Senate. If I can defer to Greg, I'd love to get his take.
All right. We have our first deferral. I like it.
I worry about it long term. I mean, you know, I think that, and this is an area that I think the Federalist Society has performed a noble function in sort of defending the independence of the judiciary, in at least with Republican appointed nominees, helping ensure that we nominate folks who are committed to the rule of law seriously and are not partisan actors. But long term, I mean, I worry about it. I think politicians on both sides of the aisle are getting more and more brazen in attacks on the judiciary, more and more willing to misrepresent rulings they don't like in kind of partisan terms. That gets picked up in social media. People don't understand what the court has said. They just understand the outcome. And that's all really corrosive. And as much as I'm happy right now that we're in this world where there's no longer a filibuster in the Senate, part of me worries that that enables a future, I don't know how many years from now, when presidents and their parties really expect nominees to be partisan warriors and to be able to confirm them in a way that wouldn't have been true 10 years ago. I mean, you can imagine whoever the senator you don't like getting powered through to the Supreme Court now in a 50-50 vote, which would have been inconceivable when there was even the possibility of a filibuster kind of required folks to White Houses to choose nominees who had no paper trail, but were also kind of judicial by nature and not partisan by nature. So it's I think it's a long-term worry.
Sam, any thoughts on?
I completely agree with Greg regarding the filibuster. It makes the ease of getting a nominee through on a 50-50 vote, even though, Jeremy, I know that ease is a relative term. for doing that, I've been through many confirmation battles, as has Greg, and although Greg has been through many more than I have been, it's going to be much more of a nakedly political process now, which is unfortunate. In the silver lining category, however, it does lend some more transparency to what's going on here, because the, you know, people have argued for a long time that judges have their policy positions and they're just using certain intellectual disciplines to hide them or to legitimize them. And there's been a certain amount of double talk when it comes to the judiciary. And that, you know, for example, do we really believe that a Democratic administration is does not know whether its nominee is pro-choice when they put them on, you know, when they nominate them, for example, and the other way around for Republicans? You know, I don't think many people take that idea seriously. So it makes it much more nakedly political, it's true. And it raises the stakes. But in a way, that's kind of overdue, because the questions that are facing the country now as we go forward are in somewhat in tied to that increased rhetoric, I believe. The degradation of political speech in our lifetimes is something I think that we all abhor. It's really bad, and it's getting worse. And the role of the judiciary is incredibly important in doing that. And what I think may be important is each side getting the feel that at least what's happening is above board. At least that the judges are making decisions that can be read, can be understood, that they're coming from a certain viewpoint. And it's not this just rote exercise in pretending that they don't have any opinions on anything. And because that was, I think, contributing to a great deal of skepticism. And so that's the silver lining to this increased, because as Greg has pointed out in one of his prior TV appearances, that the use of the filibuster in judicial nominations is actually quite rare until the recent past, right? So, you know, it wasn't really supposed to be a factor in judicial nominations. It was supposed to be, you know, straight up. And so now it is. And so now both sides get a chance to take the gloves off in terms of judicial nominations. And it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in this current administration when they get a chance to start putting judges up and we see what kinds of backgrounds and what kind of writings they have. It's going to be a very interesting and revealing discussion, I think, which I believe in transparency. I think it's good.
So we have about 5 minutes left. So I thought I would give a brief my own brief conclusion, and then give each of you about 45 seconds to say whatever you want to conclude. My own observation is that you may not be able to see it on the Zoom, but I'm wearing my Magna Carta tie, which my wife always makes fun of me for, but I like it. And there are very few times
where— Could you flash it?
So you can see the Magna Carta. But there are very few times where it's appropriate, and it occurred to me that it's particularly appropriate to this conversation because a little over 800 years ago, a group of conservative barons had to step in to put constitutional limits on the monarch and create a sort of more due process and transparency. And so it occurs to me that everything becomes new again and that history repeats itself. But with that, I'll kick it to Oren for his concluding remarks, and then we'll go around.
Well, first, thank you for the chapter again for hosting the conversation, and Jeremy for being a great moderator. I just want to say that I'm glad to be part of this conversation, and I hope that this is the beginning of a conversation that people are going to have and not the end. I think this is a conversation that's time. We should be thinking about these questions and talking about them and have been too quiet for too long. And I'm glad that we can have this forum, and I hope there are more.
Manny?
Well, this is a timely, necessary program. I think it's heard some, a lot of well-informed, good comments. We don't all agree on everything, and that's the way of the world, and that's the way it ought to be. But I just want to make a couple of recommendations before we leave. One is Charles Kessler's extraordinary book that just came out, Crisis, I mentioned before, Crisis of the Two Constitutions. As you may know, he won the Bradley Prize. Charles Kessler is a brilliant conservative scholar. And I agree with a lot of his comments, particularly about Trump and his impact and role in the presidency. There are a lot of things that Trump does that we deplore. The use of as a tool for selecting a Supreme Court justice, it's one of the great things I think that Cato helped develop with Scalia and Roger Pilon was developing the focus on originalism and having the debates with Scalia in the early days. And that has been a very important role forward to elevate the quality of the debate and discussion about who do we select to be a judge. You can't get politics out of it. But I think that the Federalist Society has performed a major role, and very admirable is the fact that Donald Trump did consult and listen to Federalist Society in determining who was qualified to be appointed. And that's a rare thing to happen. And I think we can all applaud that.
Greg?
Sure, I just wanna say again, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed this conversation with all of you. I think, as we're taking stock of where the conservative legal movement is, January 6th caused some self-reflection, so did Bostock. I think we have to be proud of what has happened over the last 3 or 4 decades. I mean, the conservative and libertarian legal movement have transformed the courts and the academy, and in some respects, public discourse. So to the extent that I've been critical in some of this hour and a half, I'm only critical because I realize there's much more work for us to do. I'm very, very pleased with the victories that have been gained over these decades, and the Federalist Society, conservative and libertarian lawyers have a lot to be proud of, even in what happened during the Trump administration. But we have a lot more work to do to defend our Constitution and rule of law. Thank you.
Sam?
I also want to thank you for including me in this discussion. It's been great. With Professor Caron, I feel like I'm a 1L again, which is very intimidating. but I think it's very, very important that we recognize that the strict construction, the textual analysis of rule of law, and consistency across decision making in the process is a tremendously important contribution to the rule of law in the United States. And we need to really, we do, like Craig says, need to recognize we've done some fantastic work in, you know, selling and creating a warm, nurturing environment where people can argue and have debates about this, where we can properly, express our views towards politics and towards law. But the important thing I think we need to keep in mind is that politics is politics. And the judicial branch serves an incredibly valuable role in trying to separate out those really intense short-term emotions that can affect so many people's lives. And, you know, we love politics. We love arguing about it. We can't seem to stop doing it. But the FedSoc has a very valuable role in making sure that the best ideas get put into place that make this country a fair, decent, honorable place to live. And that applies across, I think, all political spectrums, that's what we all want. And I know that's wishy-washy, but that's how I feel.
Well, thank you, Sam, and thank you all the panelists. It's 1:30 p.m. Pacific, so we are finishing exactly on time and very accurate for our 1.5 hours of MCLE. On behalf of the Federalist side, I'd like LA chapter, I'd like to thank all of our panelists for participating. I think this was a very thoughtful and important conversation to have, and an excellent debate. And I look forward to having more conversations in the future. And I bid you all a good afternoon, and thank you all for joining. And for those in the audience, thank you for all your questions. I'm sorry I couldn't get to all of them. We had about 30 questions, but I think I got through many of them. And thank you for watching.
Thank you.